Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your co-host, Dr. Thad Woodard. You know, as I prepared for today's program, it kind of dawned on me that this is a little bit, the program today and what we talk about is a little bit like Goldilocks, finding the porridge that was just right. And what I mean by that is the diagnosis and management of prostate cancer today is about finding the approach that's just right for each patient. This program will discuss who should be screened, what to do with that screening results, and what treatments, if any, should be right given that individual patient. Our guests today are Anchorage urologist Dr. Bill Clark and urological oncologist Dr. Josh Logan. Dr. Logan's specialty is actually cancer of the urinary system, which involves the liver, the kidney, the bladder, the prostate, and all of the urologic anatomy. You can reach us today if you have questions or comments. In Anchorage, our number is 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. And I do want to back up just a second and say that Dr. Logan and Dr. Clark both work in Anchorage at the Alaska Urological Institute. Bill Clark did his advanced training in urology at the Mayo Clinic, and Josh did his urological surgery, at least at UCLA, and his urology training, I believe, at Eastern Virginia. So welcome to both of you. You've been here before.
Thank you.
We've talked about prostate cancer a lot, and for me, one of the reasons for the program is that the recommendations, I think, for prostate cancer in particular versus, let's say, breast cancer are promulgated and pretty well disseminated but have changed and are constantly changing. And I wanted to make sure listeners had the best idea, the best information about where we are currently and why also these recommendations are changing, which gets into some of the complexities of cancer screening and cancer treatment. So let's start by asking one of you guys just to kind of give me some ideas about, and our listeners, what prostate cancer is.
Well, I'll let Josh get that started.
Sure. So cancer is a transformation of a normal cell to a cell that is unregulated, uncontrolled growth, and our bodies don't like when things aren't controlled and regulated.
So it kind of, they can, these cells do things that other cells don't do. They live in other places, but it's metastasis. They develop their own blood supply.
Mm-hmm.
They usurp energy over and above everybody else. So they're definitely different, and unlike most cells in the body, which die eventually or have a kind of a programmed cell death, if I think if I use that term right, these guys don't. They kind of
become immortal cells.
Recently, a very famous book has written about the...
Henrietta Lacks.
One of the problems in prostate specifically, though, is that as men age, the prostate does enlarge. So it has a controlled, relatively controlled growth pattern, and distinguishing kind of normal growth from the kind of out-of-control growth is making the decision and the whole treatment pattern much more complex, I think.
Yeah, and we may get into that in some detail. So to help us with, if we get there, let's understand that. So you said that the prostate gland enlarges normally with aging. Is it enlarging because it's getting more cells, the cells are getting bigger, or something else is in there in the prostate besides the normal cells?
Well, that's why we haven't had enough urologists getting the Nobel Prize, because we're still trying to sort that out. But I think all those probably, it's a multifactorial kind of scenario between genetic and probably epigenetic and you know, basically lifestyle kind of changes probably impacted more than we ever realized before.
So the next question that inevitably comes up in my mind is, well, okay, why does cancer develop? We were talking before the program. My understanding is that it is a combination of genetic chromosomal abnormalities affecting different genes. Genes make proteins. Things start slowly getting out of hand. It's happening to all of us all the time at various rates. And if certain, almost like a rate-limiting number of the wrong kind of mistakes in our genetic milieu happen because of multiple reasons, and those cancers get developed and grow out of control. But Dr. Clark and Dr. Logan said, well, wait a minute. Maybe that's the consequence of metabolic changes over time. You want to focus on or say something about that?
Yeah, so I think the mainstream contemporary thought on cancers, as you outlined, I mean, these are genetic changes, and if you sequence a given cancer, there are multiple genetic aberrations, and then we've become quite sophisticated and been able to lump them into categories of drivers and passengers. Drivers are probably mutations that are actually playing a role in the disease, and passengers are just kind of innocent bystanders, which probably aren't perpetuating the disease. But there's also a school of thought out there that cancer is a metabolic disease, that it is that the downstream genetic effects are just that. They're downstream. They're a consequence of metabolic changes maybe that occurred initially in the mitochondria. I would say that that's probably, certainly not part of the mainstream, but interesting to think about. There's certainly data out there to support some of their hypotheses, and so it's interesting to think about.
And sometimes what happens is during the evolution of the cancer itself, it can mutate or change. So that's why things sometimes, they were working for a while, all of a sudden don't work anymore. And you can actually now look at some of the genetic changes that are occurring, or maybe they're different clones in that same cancer. So it may not all be one cancer.
It's interesting, as Bill's pointing out, that they've done these studies where they've taken metastases and matched them to their clone in the organ of origin, and they further mutated once they've left the host. So these clones have changed from their parental cell.
Which I'm always quick to point out is really evolution right in front of our eyes.
I mean, absolutely.
That's what evolution
is. Yeah, it's changing. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's rapid,
and it's,
you know.
Yeah, and the changes give a certain adaptive benefit to that organ or that group of cells, and they then take advantage of that.
Mm-hmm.
Let me give our phone number again. This is Line 1, your health connection. My guests are Dr. Josh Logan, Dr. Bill Clark. We're talking about prostate cancer. If you've got questions about anything related to prostate cancer, our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. Our email address, Line 1, you spell it out, LINEONE, Line1@alaskapublic.org. And we also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. What should I ask about next? What are risk factors then? Let's just quickly go through things that we know have been associated with the increased risk of prostate cancer.
Well, I think that's relatively stable, although we're finding some new things out too. There's certainly a genetic pattern that we haven't totally sorted out, but certainly if you're father had prostate cancer, your grandfather had prostate cancer, two uncles have it, which happened just at the end of last week with a couple of patients. And, you know, those folks are definitely more likely to have prostate cancer. So family history. Additionally, potentially, although there's some controversy about it, breast cancer in the women in the family could potentially be a risk factor. There's certainly some genetic things that may be patterned or some racial disparity. Which, again, is still somewhat up in the air, but it does appear that Afro-Americans are more likely to maybe have more aggressive disease, and some Asian populations significantly less so, which, again, may be epigenetic, but certainly does seem to follow in some of those patterns. There's some lifestyle things. Certainly it appears now maybe smoking is a little bit more related to prostate cancer, obesity. Interestingly enough, some new data shows that HIV patients are less likely to have prostate cancer, which is a strange phenomenon. So, you know, it's not totally straightforward as to what all is going on.
Moving target.
The genetic issue, I'm going to make a quick comment. And again, I want you guys to tell me whether you agree or not, but my understanding is that part of the advances in understanding our genome is that we now know there are genes that make proteins. This job is, so to speak, is to clean up mutational errors. We evolutionarily, we know we make genetic, our bodies, nature knows we're going to make mistakes and has adapted systems to clean those up so they don't become problematic. And people with the BRCA, BRCA genes that is associated with increased ovarian and breast cancer have problems with that system genetically. That's why they have problems. So it's very reasonable to think that there may be other systems that are causing trouble with other cancers, and that's why we may see familial clusters of cancer. Is that makes sense to everybody?
Yeah, I think that there's a whole area of targeted therapy that is focused on PARP inhibitors. PARP inhibition is inhibiting these enzymes that repair DNA. So these cancer cells are continually replicating their DNA, and these PARP enzymes are repairing the damages that were done or errors, and so a targeted therapy is to inhibit those enzymes so they can't clean themselves up, so to speak, and then potentially go down the cell death pathway, apoptosis pathway.
So you've really we've kind of jumped ahead into where the individualized therapy has taken us, in that we are maybe approaching periods or time where we recognize each cancer is somewhat different, and that we can really look at that book of the genetic material and see where the misspellings are and begin to affect those misspellings in several ways to really very specifically treat each person's cancer is a different problem, or each person's disease even. It doesn't have to be cancer.
Yeah, there's kind of that targeted, but there's also this concept, as Josh was talking to or talking toward with the PARP inhibitors, that we call it a mutational load, mm-hmm. where you have a number of factors. I mean, some people look at the targeted therapy as having one or two genes that might, you know, we can alter those and everything will be fine. But it turns out that some of these are way more complicated than that, so right. maybe beyond what we can really do, which is one of the reasons why we're excited in the research world of looking at this immune therapy, mm-hmm. because your own system has for millions of years been able to handle those mutations. And if we could kind of shift that whole system back, then theoretically we might be able to get ahead of the game is the idea.
And I think patients and listeners may get really turned on by this idea like we do, but you need to do the science. I want to caution everybody is that once you start monkeying around with our immune system and how it responds, sometimes untoward factors, things happen, and that's why you've got to proceed pretty slowly and why it can seem like it takes forever to get really good documentation that this is safe and effective. It might be effective, but it may be worse than the individual problem you're trying to cure, so you got to be careful, and it takes some time. All right, so I put down what are symptoms, and talking about diagnosis is kind of next, but one of the things I think is probably important to recognize, most people with prostate cancer don't come in with symptoms. They get noticed by screening nowadays.
Yeah, so that's the hope, is that with screening, you'll detect it before symptoms developed. I'm routinely asked by patients, what should I experience if I have prostate cancer? Well, hopefully none. You know, hopefully we got to you, you know, before it got to that extent. Typically, symptoms are associated with advanced disease, in which the paradigm shifts from can we cure the patient to how do we control this?
All right. So what would be some symptoms that we don't want to hear about?
Well, some of the classic ones that, as I talked to you before, is that as you age, sometimes difficulty with urination, frequency, urgency, kind of slow stream can be a problem. Certainly if you saw blood in the urine, that would be the concern. Kind of people don't like to talk about it too much, but erectile dysfunction can be the same. Mm-hmm. And so ED can be another sign of some potential problems as well. So those are probably the ones that are the primary symptom complex.
All right. So basically, if you're having some blood in your urine, pain with urination, maybe erectile dysfunction, more and more difficulty urinating, all those things could be cancer, could be something else. The bottom line is those things need to get investigated. All right. So it turns out, however, that most individuals that get diagnosed nowadays are asymptomatic and get diagnosed by screening. And screening has been a source of some concern. Initially, wow, good idea. Then, whoa, wait a minute. Maybe we're over-diagnosing and we're getting more complications from the screening. So let's talk about screening. What do we talk about? What how do we screen nowadays?
So traditionally, screening for prostate cancer is two-part. It's the PSA, or prostate-specific antigen, which is a protein that's detectable in the blood, and that coupled with a what we call a digital rectal exam. And that is traditionally what screening for prostate cancer entails, at least kind of the initial screening test that's done. Bill may want to talk about some of the molecular tests that are coming online that may be transforming that, although progress in that area has been slow. But that is the typical way in which screening has been done. That's really widespread screening really began in the early 90s. And became pretty commonplace throughout the remainder of that decade and the last decade. And during the course of that, we certainly saw a decline in the mortality associated with prostate cancer, and there was a lot of excitement, I think, associated with that decline in mortality. But there was also concerns about at what cost. You know, what did it cost, you know, a population of men to cure a subset of them? There was issues with urinary incontinence post-surgery. There were side effects associated with radiation that people were receiving. There were erectile function issues. And so there was, in some respects, a great cost to be paid with the screening. But I like to think that as technology and techniques have improved, that we've seen improvements and side effects associated with treatment. So a lot of benefits, I think, have come out of the 20-plus years of robust population-based screening, and that is, with the recognition of over-treatment, i.e. development of side effects, we have uncoupled screening from diagnosis, from treatment. It wasn't that long ago that was just a package deal. You were screened. If it was high, you got tested. If it was positive, you got treated. We've since come back and said, no, all these things need to be separate entities that need to be thoughtfully worked through at each decision point. So screening has changed quite a bit in the time that I've been involved in the specialty, and I think it's becoming more precise. And is there room for improvement? Absolutely, but we've certainly improved in the time that we've been doing it.
So as a consequence, and Bill, I know you want to. So as a consequence for listeners, 5 or 6 years ago, we did this program like this, and we were saying the current evidence is, well, maybe we shouldn't even be doing screening. And tell me if I'm wrong. Right. And now the most recent stuff is suggesting there's probably real advantage to doing it, but it's uncoupled, as Josh is saying. Now when we take these results, let's talk about the individual situation with each patient about where we're going with that kind of information.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. And being an old guy, I can tell you, going back to the pre-PSA time period, which is where I started, and Josh is too young to remember those days, but when I started, we actually had no PSA. We had a digital rectal exam, which is taking a feel and looking for lumps and bumps on the prostate, and about 70%+ of the patients we had with the initial diagnosis were essentially already metastatic disease, which was a really bad place to start. And over the time, the last 30 years plus, I don't like to say how old I am, but the things have changed so that now, at least as of the time when the task force made that decision 2 or 3 years ago, the incidence of metastatic disease at diagnosis had dropped to well below 10%. And the thing that I think got somewhat thrown out with the baby in the bathwater sort of thing is that the incidence of prostate cancer death actually dropped better than 40% during that time period, which is obviously what you're trying to prevent. And during that time period, baby boomers were actually increasing in number, so the prostate cancer death rate should have increased. So something really came about during that time period, and not much change other than the screening and PSA. Mm-hmm. What also has happened in the meantime with the treatment side of things is treatments have become much better, as Josh said, and we're much more nuanced in who does need treatment, who doesn't. And so I think they need to be uncoupled. And that's sort of when people try to put everything together, it makes it really difficult to sort out the whole story.
Let me remind listeners again, this is Line 1, your health connection. My guests are Dr. Bill Clark and Dr. Josh Logan. Both are urologists. Dr. Logan kind of specializes in cancers of the kidney, bladder, prostate, the urologic system in humans. And we're talking about prostate cancer. So if you've got questions or comments, our local number is 550-8433. 550-8433, our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. The most recent studies that I have seen was some we talked about before we got going in the New England Journal of Medicine, where they actually looked at something called watchful waiting versus treatment, a couple of different treatments. And it went on for, I think, 6 to 10 years. Their primary endpoint on these guys who came in, 77% of them were just had a high PSA. That was all that was noted, and they followed them for 6 to 10 years. And it wasn't long enough to really statistically say whether it decreased death or not, but what it showed was there's pretty good evidence that it's very good if we intervene in decreasing metastatic disease.
So I just want to draw one distinction between watchful waiting and active surveillance.
Okay, absolutely important.
So watchful waiting would be, looks like you've got prostate cancer, and give me a call if anything, mm-hmm. if any problems come up. Mm-hmm. Whereas active surveillance would say, you've got prostate cancer, we're going to check your PSA every 3 months. We're probably going to do a prostate biopsy as a follow-up in sometime in the near future to further characterize as a confirmation, make sure nothing's changing. So just important to draw that distinction. So really, the trial—
We had active surveillance.
Active surveillance, compared to surgery, compared to radiation. And, as you pointed out, there was no change in cause of death. And mortality rate, but there was an increase statistically significant in the incidence of metastatic disease. Those that were treated, whether by surgery or radiation, were less likely to get diagnosed with metastatic disease. I think it is important, though, because even there's a tendency to assume that in this case that metastatic disease is a surrogate marker for death due to prostate cancer, and you do have to separate those out. And just because a guy has metastatic disease doesn't mean that his mortality will be different. And I know that gets a little hard to wrap one's head around, but I think you can't use that as a
surrogate
marker
for death. Because you may die of some other reason, basically. Right.
Right. So these guys, you could be on hormone therapy and it exacerbates the coronary artery disease and death, So it's...
And your age when that diagnosis is made has something to do with it? You said...
If
you had diabetes?
Sure.
What if you had Alzheimer's disease?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So all of those things may affect when you die, not the cancer itself.
And then the other thing I would point out is, I think you've got to look at a guy with prostate cancer that has metastasis. The great majority of them really have, at least initially, have no symptoms related to that. unlike some of the other urologic malignancies that we treat, and that can be very painful if it's metastatic. But there's a lot of nuances, I think, in this. And just to get back to your point about the paper is, I think it confirmed for a lot of people that active surveillance is a legitimate approach to management of prostate cancer.
All right. We've had a number of phone calls triggered, and that's good. We're coming close to halfway through. That's not so good for me. I like to keep talking about these things. But before we go to a break and then come back and start answering some questions, what are the current recommendations for prostate screening that you guys would suggest?
So there's the United States Preventive Services Task Force, which came out a couple years ago and basically said that you shouldn't screen. Fortunately, the American Cancer Society and the American Urologic Society, based on the review of the similar data, have come to a different conclusion and said, look, you know, for the general population, if you're 55 and above and you have 10 years, at least 10 years of life expectancy, that screening is a reasonable option for you following some discussion about the risks and benefits with your provider. The caveats to that are you should probably screen a little earlier, starting at basically age 50, if you've got risk factors such as African American or you have a primary relative that's got prostate cancer, and they even bump it down to age 45 if you've got multiple primary relatives with history of high-risk prostate cancer. So that's kind of what we generally work within.
The other side of it is that some of those, I mean, talking about symptoms, some of those symptoms can be, you know, a different reason to be looking at PSA. So if you do have some of those, certainly all the screening data really doesn't apply, because those are supposedly asymptomatic patients who had no reason to go in and get a PSA other than they just happened to be in a screening program.
Right.
So symptoms changes the whole deal.
So be more specific about that. So if what I'm hearing you say is I'm 49 and a half, and I start noticing I'm having blood in my urine.
Or more typically, you're getting up, you know, one or two times more at night to void.
Uh-huh.
You're having to run
okay.
to the bathroom a little bit quicker. All you know, you can make it. It's not like you're going to die you know, you got to get there quickly. You have to not now think about where the bathroom is,
uh-huh.
where you didn't really before.
Right.
Or it takes you forever, three people in the stall pass.
So it suggests something's blocking the flow of
exactly.
urine. And that needs to be looked at.
And that's different than, you know, a typical thing with pain or, you know, coughing up blood and that kind of thing.
Yeah, we're talking about screening asymptomatic. That's the recommendations that Josh
Exactly.
But just to double back to one thing you said, blood in the urine. Stop. Do not pass go. Go see your doctor.
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
a problem.
Yeah.
But may not be prostate cancer. Everybody
kind
of, it's like every headache has got to be a migraine.
Sure.
No,
yeah.
that's not
yeah.
true.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
But that's not one you want to take a pass on.
Okay. All right. So let me ask the callers to hang on. And we got an email. We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back with you. You're listening to Line One, your health connection. Local number again, 550-8433. Toll free 1-888-353-5752. And our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We'll take 1 minute break and then we'll continue our discussion on prostate cancer with Dr. Bill Clark and Dr. Josh Logan. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line One on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're discussing prostate cancer, and my guests are Dr. Josh Logan, who's a specialist in dealing with cancers of the urinary system, which includes the kidneys, the bladder, testes, and prostate, and urologist Bill Clark. They both work here in Anchorage at Alaska Urologic Institute. You can email your questions to us at line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call our local number, 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And please remember, if you're listening on Monday night between 8 and 9, you're listening to a taped recording, and we will not be here to answer your questions. Let's take our first caller. Rick, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hey, Dr. Woodard and Dr. Clark. It's good to talk to you guys, and nice to meet you, Dr. Logan. Just on my way through Anchorage, heading back to Kenai, and listening to your program. And regarding the new screening guidelines, or I'm not sure if they're completely adopted yet, but I wanted to ask a question or maybe make a comment about some discussion I've had with some primary care physicians in our neck of the woods. And my comment to them was, if I'm a 50-year-old man and you were my primary care physician for the last 25 years, and you did not screen me for 25 years, and on my 50th birthday, you sent me for my PSA and it was 9, I would feel like I hadn't got the best care. So I just wanted to see what you guys' opinion was about the, you know, no PSA till you're 50.
Yep. All right. Reasonable question.
Well, I think that you bring up some good points, and I think that it's important for people to stay informed and not wholly rely on their physician to figure out what they need. It's a relationship. It should be a two-way street. We talk a lot about shared decision-making, and I think PSA in that regard is no exception. Asking a physician, hey, what do I need, and at my given age, what's indicated, and then again, oneself should stay informed about the kind of things that would be considered good preventative health maintenance, such as a screening colonoscopy. When should you start that? Being informed about, you know, what types of things run in your family. What did your grandparents die of? What kind of medical problems did your folks have? And just being an informed person about that aspect of your life. Certainly, you have to rely on them to some extent, but I think, it comes back to a relationship, and I think it's important to stay informed.
I looked at this, Rick, I heard your question a little differently than Josh did. I heard maybe that you were asking, is it right not to screen people until age 50, but maybe we ought to be screening people younger, and you question the guidelines?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I sure want to know what my PSA is, or I did before I was 50, and
right.
I'm pretty sure most doctors know what theirs is, and so I just... You know, when I've asked my internist, you know, how would you feel if, you know, you sent me when I was 50 and I had a PSA of 9, I kind of get blank stares, and they kind of look down and say, yeah, okay, I get it.
But, well, I think part of the issue comes from these recommendations are really directed at populations and not individual between a physician and the patient. And I guess the point I'm trying to make is recommendations are population-based. Right. And they don't have the granularity of, well, what about this patient or what they're looking at, you know, large populations so they can make decisions about, you know, lots of decisions financially. How do we pay for this? What makes sense? I mean, we get down to numbers like what's the number needed to screen to save one life? And those numbers get really big, and then it's somewhat arbitrary about where those lines in the sand get drawn to say, well, we think it's reasonable to screen 1,000 men to save one man's life. Your point is well taken, that I think I would feel the same way if I sat down and asked that same question, but they're kind of, I think, in large part following guidelines, which again, there's a disconnect between population-based decision-making and individual patient-physician shared decision-making.
All right, well, thanks, guys. Good talking to you.
All right, yeah, thank you, Rick. So, yeah, another issue is you, if you're screening for a problem that is not very common, even a test that is 95% accurate has 5% out of 100 is going to be wrong, and you're screening at things that are happening, you know, if you're screening 20-year-olds for prostate cancer, your chances are, I don't know, one in, let's say, several hundred thousand, you're going to pick it up. You're far, 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 far more likely to have a false positive test than a real test, which leads to a lot of extra costs and morbidity. So somewhere you have to begin to draw the line population-wise, but an individual, it's a different story. So a 50 or 45-year-old black guy comes in and says, both of my brothers just died of prostate cancer.
Yeah, that's a problem.
That's a different issue.
Yep.
And so, and these are guidelines. They're not something against the law to do.
Yep.
Let's see here. We got some people holding for a while. Let's do Michael on line four if we can. Michael, welcome to line one.
Hi, this is Mike Singsaw. I'm a former partner of Bill Clark.
Yeah, I've heard your name.
I was your neighbor at one time.
Dr. Singsaw, Josh Logan, it's nice to meet you.
Same.
I've heard a lot about you.
They have a discussion when you get to it as far as treatment goes. Even being a retired urologist, you find out you're doing things in, perhaps in your own family, and certainly relatives who might be suspicious for having prostate cancer. I would suggest that you talk about the options and how we make decisions on what stage grade and all that is, and how that affects what we would suggest for treatment or non-treatment. And the second thing would be, is it available nearby or here or coming to have a screening, not screening, but prosthetic guided biopsies with CT combined ultrasound and CT, which has been shown with some validity that it's a more sensitive test in those who you have persistent elevated PSAs and negative biopsies. I'll leave it there.
Okay. Yeah. So what I'm hearing Mike Singsaw say is in the big sense is we're getting constantly better and better and better at diagnosis, which we talked about earlier, and that kind of always changes the algorithm a little bit to some degree. And he's mentioning a couple of better ways that we might be more precise in getting the diagnosis by biopsy.
Sure. Yeah. Well, good to hear you again, Mike. I think I'd kind of take your questions backwards and look at the first one being, I think, more likely, you're referring to MRI and the prostate, which is kind of a synchronized biopsy. The idea that by taking some of the new data, looking at more accurate definition of where the prostate might have tumor or whether it does have tumor, MRI has been more effective at doing that in several studies. There's still some kind of controversy about how accurate that is, and whether or not it's dependable enough to be used by itself. And there are different grading systems that are utilized, and that kind of becomes somewhat of an issue about that. So I think the combined ultrasound, or they call a fused biopsy, is looking better. But even most of the people that do recommend that recommend a random biopsy along with it to look at the statistically more likely areas to be containing tumor, and there does seem to be considerable issues about potential upgrading of those biopsies. So I think it's kind of a technology and evolution. The other issue, just from a practical standpoint, is some of the insurance companies are not paying for it, so it's a pretty spendy test, and I think it's not totally kind of the absolute answer. Treatment-wise, there's certainly some different options, and I think the biggest thing has changed since kind of you were back with us is the surveillance option, I think, is much more in vogue, and I think we're getting better at trying to determine who would be a better patient for that, whether it be on the grade of the tumor, the volume of the tumor, location of the tumor, and I think those are really helpful. And I think we now have some genetic tests which also sort of direct you a little bit more to who might have more aggressive or less aggressive diseases. I think the other thing that's changed is really the treatments themselves have become much better, and I think probably radiation therapy has made more advances than we've made on the surgical side, although it's certainly, in both instances, much less in the way of problem with potency and certainly urinary control, which was much more of an issue before. And a lot of what the task force kind of segued into in their testing or in their recommendations for screening were based on side effects of the treatments. And I think that has changed considerably from when they were using their data looking at long-term side effects of treatment versus what they are today. So I think lots of things have changed in regards to the consequences of treatment versus what we had before. So I think we're definitely better. And Josh can talk a little bit more about that too.
Yes. So regarding the MRI fusion biopsy, you know, it's a technology that's certainly attractive. It's evolving quickly. Currently, the recommendations are for a standard template biopsy. And if the biopsy comes back negative and there is continued suspicion that we may have just simply missed it, then the fusion biopsy is indicated in that follow-up space. That being said, you know, there are instances in which, as you're, I'm sure, aware, people and patients were reluctant to proceed with biopsy based on an elevated PSA alone. And a prostate MRI in that case has, in some instances, shown a suspicious lesion which can be targeted. I would caution that to just to note that there are instances certainly in which there are MRs that come back normal, no identifiable lesion, and there's cancer in the gland. So it's exciting. There's things changing, but you know, it still has its limitations, as with any test. But it does put another option on the table for us in our management and approach to, say, an elevated PSA. And I think the other comment you made was really directed at kind of, you know, directing, selecting care based on a given individual's not only the disease characteristics, but their overall health and certainly mostly their preference, because all patients come with their own set of expectations and preferences about how they want to approach this issue.
And I think life expectancy as well is another significant and generally pretty easily obtained data point. If you're not likely to have a 10-year life expectancy, then certainly your prospect for treatment might be significantly altered based on that as well.
Yeah. Mike, that help you?
Yeah. Well, so no, I wanted to be sort of a springboard for a discussion.
Yeah, good.
Because people call and talk to me still all the time. And you have to discuss this stuff with them. And,
right.
And it's confusing if you sometimes even are a urologist as to exactly what's going to be the best thing. But
right. You
have to present to the patient what his stage is and grade and the whole thing and how he came up with our recommendations and what his choices are as a patient with the prostate cancer.
Yep. It's definitely getting more and more and more complex, and that's the reason we need to keep studying and have somebody that keeps up on this. So thanks for your call, Mike.
Okay.
All right. Email, wondering if those people diagnosed with testicular cancer at higher risk for prostate cancer later in life. Anybody want to try to answer that one?
I'm sure you could do a quick PubMed search and find a population-based study to support that. I don't know off the top of my head.
My thought, I saw it come. I had time to think about it just a little bit. Two reasons to think it might, and that, not saying by all means that it is. One, you know, if you had one cancer, you're probably a little bit more likely to have a second. Two, the treatment of the one cancer may change things enough to increase your risk for other cancers. We're seeing that in some time. So I would have to say that it's a possibility. And again, it gets into this individualized management. And that's why you got to talk to somebody and make some individual decisions on it, Bill.
Yeah, the only thing additionally I'd add is there is some interesting new population data that says that the lower testosterone may make you more likely to have prostate cancer or maybe more aggressive prostate cancer. And those patients that have had treatment for testicular cancer, certainly lost a testicle or had some other treatments, may potentially be more likely to have a lower testosterone, which might potentially lead to the increased incidence in prostate cancer, if indeed those, I mean, we're taking several steps forward.
There's three reasons.
But anyway, that's...
we don't know for sure, but individually it's the reason to question.
Sure.
So I guess if it was me and I was 50 or 45 and a half...
With a history of testicular cancer, I think getting a PSA is reasonable.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
John, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Thanks for putting you on the program. I'm over 80, fit, but I have prostate cancer. My question is about PSA. Mine has doubled in the last, each year, the last 2 years. It's now at a 7.3. And my question is, to what extent can PSAs, how high can they go? And to what extent are they, when is pain going to kick in? And, what is the mortality indicator with respect to PSAs?
So there's a nice paper that was published on this looking at PSA doubling time as it relates to prostate cancer mortality. It was published in JAMA, Journal of the American Medical Association. The primary author was Stephen Friedland. And you can look at the duration of the doubling time directly correlated in their study to life expectancy.
Life expectancy due to prostate cancer or life expectancy?
Prostate cancer.
Okay.
So doubling time of a year in that study was actually favorable. As opposed to men who had doubling time less than, say, 3 months. That was typically associated with a more virulent disease, more progressive, rapidly progressive disease.
And typically that's over a period of probably 2 to 3 years, actually. So it's a significant number.
And so with your PSA at, what'd you say? I think you said 7.5.
Right.
And I'm not sure how far out from treatment, if you ever had any treatment, but you know, there's certainly a lot of nuances in your particular case that could be discussed and come to bear. Generally speaking, with a PSA of 7.5, symptoms are quite a ways off. Your other question about how high can PSA go is it can just very, very high through the thousands.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah.
All right, thanks for your advice.
Sure.
You bet, John. Ursula, you're on line one. What kind of question do you have?
I was curious about the Gleason number. I never hear that mentioned in terms of aggressiveness of cells after a biopsy is done and cancer is detected.
So I like to say there's two important things about any given cancer. What's the stage? What's the grade? Stage gets at how far has it spread, or is it still confined to the organ of origin? And then secondly, what's the grade? The Gleason score, which you're referring to, is the way in which specifically prostate cancer is graded. Dr. Gleason was a pathologist at the University of Minnesota, 50, 60 years ago, described this means to grade prostate cancer. And when the pathologist looks underneath the microscope, they see that the prostate cancer forms patterns. And Dr. Gleason recognized that those patterns were directly associated with how clinically aggressive the cancer was. over time, that system has become modified. So the system originally was a score of 1 through 5. And Dr. Clark probably remembers 1s and 2s. I don't. The system is now effectively a 3, a 4, or a 5. And there's generally 2 numbers in that score that reflect that there's more than one pattern present typically. So the lowest effective score you could have is a 3+3, and the highest score you could have is a 5+5.
Okay, so I'm curious, if someone had a 5 and a 4, and then about a year later their PSA was inching up, and the decision was to just monitor it for several months, I don't know, it just seemed like that's an indication something is going on, and monitoring and waiting and seeing is not the right choice.
You're right. You know, that what you described, a Gleason 5+4, is high risk, considered high risk prostate cancer, and with a rising PSA, again, like with the last call, there's certainly more nuances to that that would have potentially weighed in on that decision. I'll let Bill weigh in on that.
Yeah, I think there's, you know, if you look at the higher risk, or what we try to separate these cancers into high risk and moderate or low risk, and the high risk 8, 9, or 10 is certainly considered high risk just by itself. There are other things that could potentially make it more so, I suppose, but just based on that, it would be high risk. I think the treatment options would sort of depend on what the individual patient status is, whether, you know, they either have other comorbid things, you know, heart diseases and reasons for not treating. But I think across the board, that would be one that I would certainly be much more concerned about. And with the rising PSA, it would sort of make me more concerned, although
this was treatment after options. Like 16 weeks of radiation, and they thought they had it all.
Well, radiation after treatment is somewhat of a different story for sure. I mean, the different treatments, especially radiation, can initially be really troublesome for following PSA. There can be kind of these syndromes that go on, and one of the classic ones they refer to as PSA bounce, where it can actually go up or down much more than you're comfortable sometimes with in our surgical patients. So I think that would certainly be a little bit different case for sure.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
So what I heard you say, Bill, is that, yeah, again, we get to this individual. Everybody's got to have all this. It's kind of a dragnet. When I was a little kid, I want nothing but the facts, but all the facts, and let's get them out there. So it could be that in that particular case is what I'm hearing you say, the treatment may have caused the high PSA that was going on. We know we got a cancer that we need to be treated. They treated it, and so don't overinterpret
and especially
recommendations
in the, here. In the first 2 to 3 years after radiation, that's certainly the case. I do a fair amount of our research protocols, and one of the things in the patients who are post-radical prostatectomy versus post-radiation, there's a significant difference in who's actually considered by the FDA to be advancing disease. And typically in radiation, presently the FDA says unless your PSA is at least 4 to 5 post-radical or post-radiation therapy, that you're not considered in these trials. So it has to be much higher than would be usually 2 or less oftentimes after radical prostatectomy. So there are different categories to look at, and radiation is particularly more troublesome in that sense.
All right, I'm going to move on. Ursula, thanks for your call. Fred, you're on line one.
Yeah, hey, good afternoon, guys. I have a question as far as, you know, prostate maintenance, as far as specific food groups that, I've read quite a bit about a few that are good for prostate health. And also I do saw palmetto. I was wondering what your thoughts about that are, if that is actually a good maintenance supplement.
Okey-doke.
So salt palmetto has been studied for lower urinary tract symptoms, and if there was a benefit, it was marginal, certainly not a robust benefit. I know it's one of the more commonly used nutraceuticals for prostate health. But again, the studies that were done didn't strongly support it. regarding diet and prostate health. You know, that's a great question. I wish we had more definitive answers for you. That seems to be a moving target, just like most of everything else we discussed today. There is some interesting data coming out now about carbohydrate-restricted diets and maybe having improvement, particularly in men with prostate cancer. So that doesn't speak to overall prostate health, but that's probably the most recent thing I've seen with regards to prostate cancer.
There does seem to be an
association. Oh, I'm sorry.
There does seem to be an association with obesity, and I think a lower BMI does have a better track record for survival as well as symptom improvement. And there's some interesting data about looking at sort of more vegan diets being kind of in the same line as the carbohydrate-restricted diets being more favorably kind of showing some response.
Does that PSA number, is it possible to lower that with, I mean, if you target certain foods, or how does that work? I mean,
That's a good question, and that's kind of the ongoing studies right now. And so hopefully that would be a surrogate, although there's a question of whether that's a good way to monitor the progression of cancer as well. So it's kind of a work in progress. I think most of the things are primarily looking at kind of some relatively broad-based epidemiologic and statistical studies. And so it's hopefully, as Dr. Logan said, going to be something we're going to be able to more definitively say in the future, but probably is not going to be tomorrow before we have that answer. But not being fat and probably being less carbo-loading is going to, at this point, look like the most appropriate approach to take.
And be active.
And absolutely be active.
Thanks for your call, Fred. All right, we just got less than a minute. There was a call that I'm not going to be able to take. It looks like the note is something about risk from screening. We've kind of talked about risk from screening. There's definitely risk
over-treatment,
which leads to over-treatment and cause side effects and problems. So that's one of the reasons why you have to balance these issues. Just screening sounds like a great idea till you really start paying attention to what you get when you screen and the age and the situation. So it has to be individualized. All right, we have very little time left, just less than a minute. I always like to end with what's your recommendations, or what do we want to take away from this? So somebody tell me real quickly, what do we want to take away from this visit, this program?
I think that you should have shared decision-making with your primary provider about whether or not screening is right for you based on your family health, based on your overall health, and make a decision about what's best for you and get off the couch, get out there, and be active.
My quick two cents is exactly that, and my quick mantra for my patients is what's good for your heart's good for your prostate, so basically, the same sort of thing you're doing for overall health is probably the way to go.
All right. My thanks to Bill Clark and Josh Logan from the Alaska Urologic Institute. It's been a very fast and educational hour for me. I hope everybody got as much out of it as I did. If you want to continue this discussion on prostate cancer, you can join KSKA on Facebook, and you can find that link at our website, www.alaskapublic.org, where you also find a link to today's program if you want to listen to it again in the archives. Next week, our co-host Prentice Pimperton and I are going to open the phone lines and have you guys, listeners, call us about any questions you want us to try to address about psychological or physical health. Of particular interest might be ADHD, asthma, allergies, depression, anxiety, some of those things that affect large portions of the population, but we'll take whatever you want us to talk about. That'll be next Monday at 2 p.m. Eric Bork was today's audio engineer, and he's also our web editor. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.